Welcome to Law & More, the podcast from award-winning Hong Kong law firm Bowes Cohen & Collins that explores issues in the legal world and beyond. This time, our senior partner, Colin Cohen, speaks with Victor Apps, chairman of the Business and Professional Federation of Hong Kong and formerly a senior insurance executive and member of the election committee. Victor looks back on his career and also addresses two issues on which he and the Federation have been particularly vocal, the Mandatory Provident Fund and poverty in Hong Kong. Stay tuned.
Victor, welcome to Law & More. How's life been treating you over the past few days?
Well, pretty good. Getting ready for Christmas. See, we've got these two wonderful twin granddaughters in town and we spend a lot of time with them. It's very good. It's nice to be in a COVID-free place.
I think it is. Okay, before I talk about your globe-trotting career in the world of business, let's go back in time just a little bit. You were raised in Britain, UK. You went to school there. And you actually went to the same university, Cambridge. So tell us a little about the early days. How did you end up in the same college at Downing as me?
I was born in a working class background, I'd say. My dad was a bus conductor in London. And I was lucky when I was 11 to get a scholarship to the Latimer School in London, when the old days of direct grant schools, where you could go to these really good schools with the government paying. And from that, I managed to get to Cambridge. And I was the first person in my entire family ever to go to university. I'm talking about dozens of cousins and aunts and uncles. I was the very first. So it was exciting and gave me a lot of opportunities from then on.
Just out of interest, what made you take maths and physics? It's an unusual combination.
Well, strictly because that's the only things I could do well in those days. My grades in other subjects were so-so, but my grades in maths were always very good. So in the English system, the old A-level system, you have to focus on the ones you're good at, otherwise you don't get anywhere. And I had a very good maths teachers at my high school, and so I managed to get into universities.
Did you enjoy Downing?
Yeah, it was a great 3 years. I don't think I learnt that much, but it was a big part of my education. In those days, it was very much a split in the university between those of us who came through the direct grant route and the posh boys who went to Winchester and Harrow and all that sort of stuff. And it was two different worlds. And the world I was in was great.
Because I arrived slightly after you at Downing. Downing was a law college and it wasn't a very sort of science and math, but it was right next door to the laboratories and the buildings next door. So you had an enjoyable time there.
I had a good time. I wasn't a brilliant student, Colin. I didn't get a very good degree, but I learned a lot. Not necessarily in my lectures, but in other ways.
Surprising development. You went off to Canada to work for Manulife. Tell us a little bit about that.
The previous summer, I'd had a summer job in North America, and they were paying so much money in those days. The difference in income levels between Britain and North America at that time was like triple, almost. So it was a really financial decision. I said, well, I can go over there and I can make a bit of money, which I can't make in England at this time. But in those days, to emigrate to Canada from England was extremely easy if you were a university graduate. And so I did it. And I found a job after I arrived with Manulife. And this was just my first job. It just turned out to be my only job.
So what did you start off with Manulife?
I was a computer programmer. Back in the days when computer programming was just starting to revolutionized business. In Manulife, we had the first System 360 in Canada in the commercial sector. And so we were cutting edge, in a sense, what we were doing. And that turned out to be a very useful background because as on all the back office side of insurance companies, the IT people took over. They took over everything because they were the only ones who understood how everything worked.
And you spent some 15 years there before you were sent off to Indonesia.
That's right.
What post did you hold before you went?
Well, I was originally in data processing, and then I moved into general administration. I ran the back office, basically. I became the administration vice president for Manulife and was running all the back offices worldwide. And then I had a spell, believe it or not, as the controller of Manulife. Even though I'm not an accountant, I was actually the controller. And I did that for a few years, and I learned an awful lot doing that.
And, of course, you met your wife, who I know very
right.
well,
yes,
and your children were born in Canada.
That's right. Two kids were born in Canada.
The upheaval to go to Indonesia. What caused that? How did that come about?
I did a study myself. We called it international expansion. We were looking at new markets for Manulife to enter into. And I'd come down to three or four countries I recommended, and one of them was Indonesia. And it turned out we had an opportunity there. An Indonesian conglomerate approached us. I went out to investigate it. Basically, I thought, wow, what an amazing opportunity. And eventually I put my hat in the ring and we moved to Indonesia with our two-year-old and a four-year-old. Best decision I ever made in my life.
And what did you do? And you ran the Indonesian operation.
We started a new operation from scratch. We set up a new company and we grew it very fast. Manulife Indonesia is now a very large company, literally from scratch.
And you worked and your family started growing up in Indonesia, and then Hong Kong. I think it was in 1988?
Correct. 88, I moved to Hong Kong. I was basically given a bit of a promotion. I took over the responsibility for a group of different functions in Manulife in the regional office here, basically the back office and the territories outside of Hong Kong. And that was my first moving back into the sort of general management area, which is what I was in Toronto originally.
And Hong Kong?
Yeah, I became general manager of the Manulife Hong Kong back about 1991. And that was exciting because we were growing the Hong Kong operation very large. They've become number one in the market. Yeah. And they're also the biggest in MPF, which is another business I was very active in, setting up our MPF business. It was exciting.
I arrived in 81 in Hong Kong. You arrived a little bit later in 1988. Your views of Hong Kong pre-97, take you a long time to settle in, or used to be working as an expat?
It was pretty easy, I think, coming here. I mean, in most ways, there's plenty of support systems for expats in those days. I'm sure there still is. Not speaking the language has never been a big issue here, and still isn't, I don't think. We're always pretty happy here. The international schools here, I think, are outstanding, and our kids went to those and went on to university from that.
I think an interesting role you had was to take Manulife into Greater China. That must have been somewhat challenging, I would have expected.
Oh, yeah. Of things I look back on doing, one of the most fascinating was a negotiation to enter China. I think I did like 40 trips to China before we got our license, talking to various people. Not a transparent place in those days. There's no route to getting a life insurance license. You had to figure out your own. Eventually, we did it. And we were the second foreign life insurance company and the first with a joint venture. And that was a really exciting time. And yeah, I always remember our opening ceremony, because at the opening ceremony, we had the Prime Minister of Canada was there, Trudeau, and also the Prime Minister of China, Li Peng, at the time. So our opening ceremony in Beijing, which was quite unique in those days.
So you continued in Manulife, and in 2007 towards 2008, you decided to retire. Mm-hmm. And tell us about your last job.
Well, in my last years, I was the CEO for Asia for Manulife. It was for quite a few years. That was an exciting time because we were still expanding fast everywhere, building in places like Vietnam, where Manulife's now number one. China, I think, was the most successful joint venture there. Singapore was a major operation as well. In Japan, we got a substantial operation. There was plenty to do, and it was exciting.
And of course, one of your last responsibilities with Manulife was after Manulife became one of the main five sponsors of the Olympic Games, and you had the opportunity to look after everybody in Beijing for the Olympics.
Well, Colin, like you, I'm a big sports fan. Manulife never actually got that sponsorship. It came to us because John Hancock, who was an American company, had the sponsorship. They'd signed up for three Olympics, and Beijing was the last. And so I was given the rather terrifying responsibility of being responsible for all of Manulife's role in the Olympics. I had a wonderful thing. I had a card that entitled me to go to the IOC box every event in the Olympics. It's like paradise for a sports fan. You go to any event, no matter how popular it was, you can just walk in. You know, it's marvelous. And great seats as well.
And I took great advantage of that because I also had the opportunity to go to the Olympics.
Yeah, we saw you a few times.
Quite a few times. Actually, I was able to get you a ticket to go to the football with me.
That's right.
Well, you could have gone, but we sat together.
Yeah. God, I even met David Beckham at a basketball game.
And in the hotel I stayed in Beijing, I remember being in the lift with these massive people.
Huge.
And I was saying to them, what sport do you play? Anyway, so you retired, and I think you've been even busier in retirement, perhaps, when you were working full-time. I mean, you were the past chairman of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, and you still remain on the Governor's Council. How's the Chamber doing, and what's your involvement at the moment?
Pretty good. I'm still on the Governor's Council. It's one of the largest foreign chambers in Hong Kong. It's difficult times with the relationships between Canada and China not been at the best in recent years, as you probably know. But it's a huge relationship between Hong Kong and Canada. Half the people we meet here have got a relative in Canada, right?
Correct.
And so there's people going backwards and forwards all the time. And I took advantage of that when I worked at Manulife. We had a lot of Chinese Canadians who came here and people we sent back and all that sort of stuff.
Of course, you were previously a member of the Hong Kong Election Committee. And tell us a little bit about your involvement on the Election Committee at that time.
A few years ago now, but yeah, I was formerly the chairman of the Employers Federation of Hong Kong back in my working days. And the Employers Federation is one of those groups that has number of seats on the election committee. I was on it three times, the election committee, back in the days when we were choosing people like Donald Chang and CY Leung, those sorts of people.
Sunday was the election, and we all went out and voted. I voted, and I'm a great believer that you have an election, you exercise your right. It is fundamental. And you look carefully at the candidates as you decide who's the best ones to vote for. Mm-hmm. Your views as to the outcome of the election, as you know, the turnout rate, how do you read things?
Well, in a sense, it was quite boring. I mean, the election. In the past, we had real choices, and this time there weren't many choices. I mean, they were all pro-establishment candidates. But the thing that disappointed me is that when I looked at what the people were saying, none of them said anything. They were boring. They would talk about issues that are really important in Hong Kong, like inequality, housing, et cetera, et cetera. And what they would say is, I'm in favor of less inequality, or I'm in favor of more housing. None of them would say what specific things they should do, except in very, 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 very minor ways. I think the main thing that I didn't like about election was the lack of debate on the issues of Hong Kong. And I think Hong Kong desperately needs a debate on a lot of issues, and that you didn't see it.
Yeah,
and we're just tubbing the I'm a patriot and that sort of stuff. Well, that's fine, but what do you think we should do in Hong Kong? How should we solve the dreadful situation on housing in here? How do we deal with the inequality, which is so bad here? Nobody spoke to me on those issues, should we say.
Yeah, I was hiking and I was coming out the tube station and I asked them, what are the policies? And I got the same rhetoric. But what I think is going to be interesting, I think the jury is out on all of this. I'm going to look very, very carefully as to how the LegCo performs, the 90 people, how they debate, how they question, how they deal with policies. And I think that's the important thing to look for, not the past. It is the system. We may not like it, but I think that's the way forward, because Hong Kong can be quite good. If they say what they're going to do, well, let's see what they do.
A lot of these people, I mean, you look at the ones elected through the election committee, the 40, nobody knows much about most of those people. So we'll have to see what they do. We've got the situation now that political parties are almost a negative. They shouldn't be. I mean, the idea of having a series of different parties that have different views on issues.
So let me sort of develop that a bit with you. You have formed the Business and Professional Federation of Hong Kong. You're currently the chairman.
I didn't form it. It's been around for a long time.
Okay. And tell us a little bit more. Our listeners will be quite interested to know more about this organization.
The BPF originally came out way before my time, was formed from the members of the Hong Kong Advisory Committee on the Basic Law, before the Basic Law came out. So a long while ago. And when that committee was disbanded, a number of them got together and started the BPF. And some of them quite well-known people. Vincent Lowe was one of the main ones. He's still the president of the group now. Sir David Akers-Jones, who passed away a couple of years ago, was also very active in his earlier days. And I just came in later on. It's a think tank where we discuss strictly Hong Kong issues. We don't talk about anything else. And the focus of what we talk about is healthcare, housing, inequality, poverty. We talk about MPF, the pension, all that sort of series of issues. They're the things that we focus on.
One of the areas which you have written about and from your experience at Manulife is Mandatory Provident Fund.
Yeah.
I would have thought that this would have come up more in the elections, but it did not. What's your views on this as to this scheme we have in place?
Well, I think MPF was set up because what it replaced was nothing. Before MPF, virtually nobody had a pension in Hong Kong except the government employees. And a few people who were lucky enough to work for 20 or 30 years for one of the big Hongs, they had pension plans, but nobody else. And MPF was the first universal type plan that they had in Hong Kong that everybody contributed to. And huge supporter of it from day one. I was, so was the BPF. The disappointing thing about it is that there's a lot of work still needs to be done on it. For example, the contribution levels clearly aren't high enough. The 5 plus 5%, 10% in today's world just does not generate a pension. You can't put aside 10% of your money for 40 years, 35 years of work and expect to survive the additional 30 years of retirement on it. It's not possible. The numbers don't work. It's got to be absolute minimum 15 is required. But nobody talks about that. Everyone's scared of saying do it. And our recommendation is the government should start putting some money into it. The government ran MPF on the basis of it being totally zero cost to them. There's 5% employer, 5% employee. They even took the cost of the MPFA and charged that off to the funds. So they based on the fact it costs zero. That's not reasonable. I mean, it's quite logical for the government to contribute something to the pension. And our recommendation is they should go to 5-5-5, employers 5, employee 5, and the government 5.
That's a sensible proposition.
I think so. And the scandal, of course, is the offsets. they introduced these appalling offsets to the pension plan when it first came out. And it was done as a compromise to get the business lobby to support it. So I guess from that point of view, just to get it in, maybe not a bad idea at the time. What the effect of the offsets is that it's decimating the pensions of the people that most need it. Because the people that switch jobs a lot tend to be the bottom end, not the top end.
And just to help our listeners here, the offsets are very, very simple, very straightforward. But as an employer, put in my 5%, my employee then leaves, or for any reason whatsoever, and gets severance payment and long-term service payment. And of course, the contributions are set off.
Mm-hmm.
And in essence, they get less.
Which is ridiculous. They basically never got their 5%. And that's a scandalous situation. Now, Carrie Lam said 3 years ago she committed to eliminating that. And it's taken ages and ages to get anything done. They're completely bogged down with this. They call it the EMPF, a new computer system, which nobody believes will work. Or everyone's very suspicious of it. And we're concerned in the BPF that they're just going nowhere on. They're not looking at the changes, that the offsetting thing is still 3 years away now.
Yeah. I now want to talk a little bit about the other topic, inequality and poverty. You've authored various reports, you've written in the newspaper and all of that. And I wrote in my blog, one of my recent blogs, which you told me off, actually, and I said that 23.6% of the population was living in poverty, and this was reduced just to 7.9% after government assistance. And you took me to task, and you think my figures were wrong.
Well, it's not your figures that were wrong. You were making a mistake and believing the government figures. The government poverty statistics are absolute nonsense. They are not poor. They are absurd.
Tell us why.
Well, the way they do it, the basic methodology they use is to take that anybody who has less than half of the median income is in poverty, right? Which is what they use in some other countries, right? So that means in Hong Kong, the way they use it, it's not median income, it's median salary, which is quite a different number, by the way, because income is salary plus all your other incomes, investment income, that sort of thing, dividend income, capital gains, all those things. That's what constitutes income. But in Hong Kong, they don't recognize that. They only talk about salaries. They just use the fact if your salary is less than half the average, you're in poverty. Now, this is not totally ridiculous for people who are working, but it is totally ridiculous for people who are retired. Because what they do is they say, well, somebody like me, and I'm not poor by any means, I don't have a salary. So therefore, the way they define it, I'm in poverty. Also, they take no account of assets in their calculation. So it doesn't matter how much money you've got, you're in poverty. All they look at is salary. The result is that if you study the government poverty report, you'll see that it says that over half the people in poverty on their measure own a property in Hong Kong without a mortgage. Now, owning a property without a mortgage is probably the counter definition of poverty. It's the opposite of poverty. So what they're doing is when you say the number of people in poverty has gone up, all it means is the number of old people has gone up. Of course, the number of old people goes up each year. Now, the government, by having a meaningless measure, can then turn around and say to you, oh, but of course, it doesn't work very well. So it hasn't. So you have to account for that. But they make no attempt to do it right. And they produce massive, long, detailed reports about poverty, all of which are absolute rubbish.
How would you deal with it? If it is inequality here, there is a poverty gap. What's the solution?
One of the things is to get decent statistics that figure out how many people in poverty. It's not that difficult. You just define the system differently. You define it as some combination of income and assets. Anybody who's got assets above a certain level is clearly not in poverty. And if you do it that way, you get a much more sensible number. It's a joke. It's a joke. The whole thing's a joke.
Hopefully the new LegCo people will look at it and the new people who've been elected might come up with some policies that could.
And I think the people on the Poverty Commission ought to do so. You've got a whole bunch of noble, well-known Hong Kongers on the Poverty Commission. Yep. They just sit there and ignore it. You know?
Let us move away from these sort of vexed and difficult political issues and talk a little bit about some of your passions here. I know one of your big passions is collecting stamps. I have it on very good authority that you've amassed a huge collection of stamps here, and you're rather a hoarder. You just want to keep it forever and ever. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm interested in that.
I find it a fascinating hobby. I've got a massive stamp collection, as you say. Like, I think that's 600 or 700 albums nowadays. And it's a worldwide collection of all things. It would fill up this whole wall here. I just love doing it. I find it interesting because when you look back at old stamps, you learn a lot about the history of the places as well, because at any given point, the stamps of a place reflect what the current political system is and who's in charge.
Keeps you occupied.
Very much so. It's been great during COVID, actually.
And one of your other passions, you're a massive sports enthusiast. What made you go for that wonderful team in West London, Fulham? Because I'm a massive Chelsea fan.
Yeah, well, I was brought up in Fulham, and what's the station, railway station? Fulham Broadway. Of course it is. Chelsea's actually the other Fulham team, we call it.
Yeah, it's only one team in West London, by the way. Anyway.
And so in Fulham, everybody was either Chelsea supporter or Fulham supporter. Right? But the house I was brought up was three streets away from the Fulham ground. And I went to primary school about 200 yards from the Fulham ground. It was absolutely automatic. You wouldn't dare be anything else, to be honest, in school in those days. And so I became a Fulham supporter when I was like 5 years old. And I've been supporting them for 60-something years. Yeah.
My team is not top of the Premier, and your team is top of a championship, despite a recent little dip in form. But you have a habit of going up and going down. It's a wonderful habit, isn't it?
It's a yo-yo team. We're never boring. The last 4 years have either gone up or gone down. And this year we might get up again. So it'd be nice to settle in the Premiership for a little bit again.
But... And also, you and I have a sort of record. Both you and I have been to the Rugby World Cup finals, the World Cup finals, the Cricket World Cup finals.
Yeah, I beat you, though, because I was at the World Cup final when England won in 1966. England's three World Cup triumphs, I was at all three. I was at the rugby when they won it in Australia, and I was at the cricket when they won it in England.
I was there as well.
Yeah, so you got two out of three.
But I got two out of three.
You can't go back and do 66.
I can't do that.
I was 18 years old at the time.
And of course, you're a big Formula One fan, and you enjoy your sport. COVID, we're watching it on TV, but you
hope... Not the same. I watched the Olympics on TV. I would have gone to Tokyo for sure to the Olympics.
Yeah, we were all booked to go to that as well, in respect to matters. In concluding, I always ask my guests on this podcast, you've lived in Hong Kong for numerous years. Is it your home? Do you intend to stay? How do you feel about that?
I'm still very comfortable here. I've been here since 1988. It's home. Most of my friends are here. If I go somewhere else, I'd have to start from scratch in a sense and be the same. And as long as it stays reasonable, I have red lines on things that would worry me about Hong Kong that would make me not want to be here. For example, if I can't use my Gmail account or I can't go on the web and things like that. So they're the sorts of lines I have. But I think we have at least a reasonable degree of freedom living here. And as long as that stays, I will stay.
I mean, we've been through some turbulent times in recent years. Your thoughts for the future?
I think Hong Kong is going to do quite well. It's going to be a different Hong Kong, obviously much more focused on China. And the future of Hong Kong depends an awful lot on what China wants to do with Hong Kong, how much they want to use it as their gateway to the world and how much they don't. That's the most important thing, the attitude of the mainland, I think.
And I hope that the border will reopen. Mm. Some semblance of travel is going to take...
Yeah, I hope all the borders open and we can get... These rather extreme quarantine rules in Hong Kong could do with a bit of reduction, I think.
I think everyone is on the same page with that. Yeah. Victor, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining Law & More.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Law & More, brought to you by Bose, Cohen & Collins. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. For more legal opinion news and updates, please visit bosecohencollins.com, or you can find us on social media. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon on our next episode.